Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
episode 4 of New Scientist. Is it April the 11th? Can't be May the 11th, I think. May the 11th. Earth's a deep, dark secret. The zombie microbes flourishing far beneath the surface could reveal a strange life's strange origins, says Graham Lawton. Now, this is interesting because life is just so hard. It's so amazing that Crick believed that it had to come from an alien civilization sending intelligent probes with it in. The first 10 million years were the worst, said Marvin, and the second million years, they were the worst too. Then the third million years didn't enjoy it at all, and after that, it went into a bit of a decline. The poor old Marvin, the paranoid Alendroy, left to wait for eternity in a car park at the restaurant at the end of the universe. But if the ordeal of this Douglas Adams character seems trying, consider the real-life fate of microorganisms discovered buried under the sediment under the South Pacific in 2010. They had been there for around 100 million years. They were still alive, barely. Their metabolisms had slowed to a crawl, and they were using what little energy they had just to stay in the game. But alive they were. They're definitely breathing, said Stephen DeHart, the University of Rhode Island, who discovered them. The presence of ancient zombie microbes entombed in deep under the Earth's surface may seem surprising, but De Holt and his crew would have been more surprised not to find them. Wherever we drill into the planet, we find life. And while some zombie-like, most is not. Life underground is rich, dynamic, and deeply strange. What it teaches us is the important implications for our concept of life itself, not just here on Earth, but on other planets too. For centuries, nobody thought the Earth's crust was anything other than inert rocks. The first hint of an extraordinary country came in 1926, when the US geologists extracted water from oil wells nearly 600 meters down and discovered bacteria swimming inside. If true, this would have been a remarkable discovery. Instead, it was widely dismissed as contamination. Attitudes towards deep life changed in 1977 when scientists aboard the US research submersible discovered hypothermal vents on the floor of the Pacific Ocean. These black smokers were teeming with life, fueled by the chemical energy from way underground. In 1992, inspired by these discoveries, boundary-breaking astrophysicist Thomas Gold published a paper called The Deep Hot Biosphere. He reasoned that similar energy sources wouldn't be confined to vents and speculated the Earth's subsurface was teeming with microbial life in the pores between rocks. The size of the biosphere might equal that of the surface life, he said, and such organisms may be widespread among the planetary bodies in our solar system. Quarter century on, gold speculations have been vindicated, at least on Earth. Drilling projects in land and sea, expeditions to deep mines and surveys of ocean vents have confirmed the existence of deep, hot biosphere of amazing size and diversity. Quote, there's an entire living realm beneath our feet, said Robert Hazen, executive director of Deep Carbon Observatory at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington, D.C. Quote, a vast biosphere that's invisible, not just because it's microscopic, but because it's literally in solid rock. It's massive, said Cara Magna Bosco. I love that. A deep life researcher at the Flatiron Institute in New York. She recently compiled data from hundreds of studies around the world to come up with an estimate of the size of the deep biosphere. Oh, it's going to be huge, you'd say. Her conclusion was staggering. Its volume is twice that of all the oceans combined? Wow. About 2 billion cubic kilometers. It contains an estimate... Oh, the volume of it. Okay, so it's not... The volume with which it exists is there. Okay. It contains an estimate of 10 to 30 microbial cells. That's 70% of all microbial life on Earth. The subsurface biosphere is the largest biosphere on the planet and holds a majority of microbial life, said Magna Bosco. Unsurprisingly, given its inaccessible location, the deep biosphere remains largely unknown. Quote, we're getting snapshots, but compared to pretty much any other environment on Earth, we have sampled very little because so much effort has to go into creating a borehole or drilling deep drill core hole in the ocean or looking at the mine, says Karen Lloyd, a geomicrobiologist at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. However, with improvements in drilling technology and DNA sequencing, she and others are gradually revealing the biosphere some call the subterranean Galapagos. Almost all the deep life is simple single-cell organisms. Most of the bacteria are care plus a few micro eukaryotes and fungi living in cracks and pores of the rock. Although there are a few multicellular animals too, most have yet to be formally identified. We call it the dark microbial matter, says Tullis Onsott, a geomicrobiologist at Princeton University. As far as we know, the biosphere extends around the world, under land, and oceans alike. It starts a few meters below the surface and goes way down. The limits of life, having drilled more than 4 kilometers into the crust under the land and 2.5 kilometers into the seabed, scientists have still never hit the sterile rock. The deepest living biological samples in Manabuleski's survey were taken at 5 kilometers down the drill sites in China and Sweden. Everyone agrees that there has to be a cutoff at some point anywhere, but where it is remains unknown. At some point, there should be temperatures that possibly also pressures that limit life because the molecules fall apart. The main limiting factor appears to be heat. On average, the temperature of continental crust rises 25 degrees Celsius every kilometer you go down. Oceanic crust, the gradient is less steep, about 15 centimeters per kilometer. I think but it still has to be less steep for a while and go up again, I would say. I would also say that's because it's thermally conducting, that would be my thing. What would quickly overwhelm the heat tolerance of multicellular organisms, but microbes are made of sterner stuff. Many extremophiles can tough out temperatures well in excess of 100 degrees where the high pressure prevents water from boiling. They can go even higher. The current record holder is Archaean Mithocandylus, which lives at 100 degrees in hydrothermal vents off the Gulf of California and has been cultured in 122 degrees Celsius in the lab. The record in the wild is set at another species, at the vent Archaeon Geogemma barrasoli, which grows and replicates at 121 degrees Celsius. It is conceivable that deep in the crust, at extreme pressures, microorganisms, so turn the page, hopefully I'll get through this, survive even greater temperatures, to say some, maybe up to 150 degrees. If so, that would push the theoretical threshold up to 6 kilometres deep on land and 10 kilometres beneath the ocean. So I think the gradient has to be bigger than the ocean. Let's just read that. If it's 150 degrees, so it's 15 degrees per kilometre, and oh, 6 kilometres on land. Oh, yeah, okay. I'll grant you that one. It's some thick ancient crust at 122 degrees isn't reached until 23 kilometres down. According to Makabiso, that pushes the envelope even further down, assuming the microbes can take the pressure. Finding out for certain, though, is a way beyond the reach of current drilling technology. The deepest hole ever sunk is Kola super deep blower hole in Russia, near the border of Norway. It began in 1970. Its scientists aimed to reach 15 kilometres down. After grinding away for nearly 20 years, they were forced to stop at 12,260 metres, governed by the higher-than-expected temperature of the borehole. Temperature and pressure are big challenges, but they are far from the only ones they face if you live underground. Rock eaters. Another challenge is energy. The two main lifestyles on the surface, photosynthesis and heterotrophy, aka eating food, rely on the presence of light and other organic matters or oxygen. Far below the surface, these are rarely on offer. Instead, organisms can have to open the box of metabolic tricks. There are some really novel biochemistry, says Hazen. In some places, there is enough organic matter, often fossilized hydrocarbons, to support communities of heterophilic microbes. Most of these are anaerobic, replacing oxygen with nitrate, sulfate, or metal ions and generating a myriad of waste products for other microorganisms to feast on. But far the most common deep lifestyle is autophagy, which means making your own food. Under the earth, microorganisms use rock itself as a source of energy. Under intense heat and pressure, chemical processes generate energy rich in organic molecules that microbes break down to produce energy. Collectively, the organisms are known as chemolithotrophs, which really means chemical rock eaters. Almost any inorganic compound can be used as a source of energy, but the most important is hydrogen. This is produced from a range of reactions between rock and water, as well as from splitting of water by the Earth's background radiation, and from silicate rocks being crushed by tectonic activities. Hydrogen eaters also produce waste. Waste products that other microbes can consume. The subsurface ecosystem is thus organized into complex food chains with primary producers at the bottom and networks of consumers feeding off their waste and that of others. There are also apex predators, sometimes microbe-eating multicellular worms, the greatest sea below left. Nonetheless, it is an environment where the pace of life is slow. In some places, life is surviving on less energy than we thought possible. This is Lloyd. I think this changes our conception of how biology works, to be more in step with the geological rhythms and processes, not the fast timescales that the surface world seems to function on. And unlike ecosystems on the surface, this one is pristine. This deep subsurface world contains one of the very few ecosystems that are pervasively altered by humans. I hope never. Given the metabolic creativity necessary to live under such conditions, many of the microbes are new to science. Quote, there's so much diversity, says Lloyd. Some microbes belong to previously unknown groups right up to the phylum level. Taxonomic equivalents of discovering arthropods and mollusks. We're inevitably surprised by what we find, said Onscott. It's even possible that an entirely new domain of life is awaiting discovery. I wonder what domain of life is, fungus or something like that. Vegetable, plant, animal. Or is it domain eukaryotic or archaic? I don't know what they mean by domain. It is even, okay, who's co-chair of the Deep Carbon Observatory Deep Life Project. At present, biologists recognize just three domains, eukaryotic, bacteria, and archaea. Okay, that's what I thought they were at, that they're the domains of life. And in eukaryote, you've got funguses, plants, and animals. Easily, and then you've got eukaryote cells. Okay, bacteria. Okay. Discovery of a third of these in 1977 led to a major revision of the tree of life. The fourth would lead to a similar revolution. Oh, okay. In 1977. It was only discovered in 1977. Wow. No wonder that our science textbooks don't have them. The diversity is so geographic, is also geographical. Just as on the surface, there are a handful of global species, but most are local. What lives where depends on the environment and available energy sources. The biggest difference between terrestrial and marine environments is between terrestrial and marine environments, said Magna Bossa. Marine sediments all tend to be quite similar because they are saturated water, whereas terrestrial ones depend on the type of rock. There are many different rock types, granite, basalt, sandstones, clays, all host very different microbial communities, doing different types of metabolism, says Magna Bosco. Some regions are rich and fecund and in a similar way to the Amazons, others are deserts with just a few species. In some ecosystems, there's only a single kind of organisms, which is kind of an alien concept, says Hazen. Even more alien, these systems can be entirely separate from the life as we know it. Some of these deep microbial domains seem to have been isolated from the surface for very, very long periods of time, says Hazen. This is perhaps the most jaw-dropping feature of deep life. In places, it's an entirely separate biosphere, running its own affairs with no connection whatsoever to life upstairs. One of the biggest implications is for the understanding of life's origins. A tantalizing possibility is that isolated subterranean ecosystems are descended from what biologists called a second genesis. The origin of life is, event separate from the one that we give rise to surface life. As yet, however, this doesn't appear to be the case. All the microbes described so far use the same genetic code and biochemistry as life above ground, so by inference are descended from the same common ancestors as Hazen. But what cannot be ruled out is that life got started underground and then spread up to the surface. Reaction in the subsurface give rise to all biomolecules that are necessary to support life, says Lloyd. As we learn more and more about life down there, we're looking in at it with an eye to determining whether it could be the origin of life too. If so, that would have gigantic implications for the astrobiology and the study of life on other planets. Plenty of other bodies in the solar systems and beyond have a subsurface not unlike Earth. If life got going underground and prospered there for the best part of 4 billion years, why not Mars and other rocket planets, even the ones with no sunlight? Also, on Scott, there are regions in Mars where the subsurface conditions are very similar to places on Earth with abundant deep life. And you don't even have to posit an underground origin, he says. On early Mars, surface conditions existed under which life could have emerged. It could quickly have migrated downwards into the subsurface. For the foreseeable future, this remains a speculation. NASA's next mission, Mars 2020, plans to drill into the subsurface and search for a signal of life, but not deep enough to reach the subsurface biosphere. We will have to wait for another mission, probably crewed one, to get the answers, says Onscott. But why stop at Mars? Quote, anywhere with enough heat to generate fluid environment at depth, you might find life, says Onscott. You could go to Mercury, to the southern pole regions of the Moon, or to Pluto. There's even talk of life on Ceres, which is a little microplanet, microplanet in the asteroid belt. Ceres. And that's a Palladius, and Ceres have palladium and cerium. If deep life is confined to Earth, many new discoveries await us. Even if deep life is concerned to life, many new discoveries await us. The Deep Carbon Observatory has only been running for a decade and has merely scratched the subsurface. I like the subsurface. Quote, I think it's safe to say that the discoveries have been made a mind-boggling and incredibly exciting success, and they open our eyes to a new kind of life. Okay, here's the thing, the greatest. The underground biosphere is pretty amazing. See the main story. Here are some of the record-breaking inhabitants. The oldest, until recently, the record holder was the archaean, or single-celled microorganism called Pyloborus fulmari, discovered in the wall of a hypothermal back smoker in the mid-Atlantic ridge of 1996. It grows optimally at 106 degrees and can survive to 113. Since it's been bested by the Geogemma barrasoli, a methane-producing archaean discovered in the hypothermal vent on the Juan de Fuca ridge in the Pacific Ocean. It can grow at and replicate at 121 degrees. The biggest, in 2011, a team reported finding a nematode worm 1.3 kilometers below ground in South African gold mine. It was later confirmed that this was indeed its natural habitat, where the microorganisms, half a millimeter long, the Helicophobus mephisto, pictured on the opposite page, is the monster on the subsurface world. It exists at the upper temperature limit of multicellular organisms, says Tufton's, part of the team to make the find. The oldest. In 2010, scientific drilling ship Geodes Resolution used an international ocean discovery program bored deep into the sediments under the South Pacific Gaia, whatever the Gaia means. In samples were microbes trapped in the sediment that were at least 100 million years old. Nobody is entirely sure how old the organisms are, but analysis suggests that they are probably several million years old. The sediment must be 100 million years old. So the individual organism is several million years old. I just find it hard to believe. scraping on increasingly scarce scraping on increasingly scarce scraps of organic matter buried alongside them, they do little more than hunker down. They're living lives of quiet desperation, says Stephen Horrock at the University of Rhode Island, who discovered them. The deepest signs seen so far come from several kilometres underground in the Kuala Deep borehole in Russia. But the project wasn't explicitly about biology, and the discovery isn't considered watertight. The deepest organisms to properly characterise are a mixture of bacteria and archaea from a 5-kilometre borehole in China. Microbes have also been discovered at 2.5 kilometres under the seafloor. Quote, maybe that doesn't sound like an impressive distance because we've used or thinking of lateral distances. But when we were drilling down a deep core, that is an impressive feat, says Karen Lloyd, a microbiologist at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. The most exclusive. Around 2.8 kilometres below the surface of South Africa's Mopeg gold mine is one of the most peculiar ecosystems ever discovered. More than 99% of the organisms are single species. The bacterium Desulfuridis ovicator, making it the world's only known one-species ecosystem. Well, I wonder if it's predating, but I think, Okay, this is coming off. I just find this hard to believe. What's the... what have they done? Have they done... What would be the last word? Puzzles? Okay. Feedback? So, it says almost, last page, it says almost the last word. Let's have a look. This is the last word, this is different. Let's start with this. Does space junk orbiting the Earth have any effect on the amount of solar energy reaching the surface of our planet, either by absorbing or reflecting it? Since 1951, more than 5,000 launches have led to an excess of 22,000 tracked objects around the Earth, but only a minority are working satellites. The rest, including satellites no longer serving a useful purpose, are debris. Many derelict craft have broken up, generating an estimated 900,000 pieces between 1 centimetre and 10 centimetres across. The staggering 128 million between 1 millimetre and a centimetre size, all of which will absorb and reflect solar radiation to extent depending on the colour and reflectivity. Travelling at speeds in the order of 10,000 kilometres per hour, even these tiny bits of junk presents a danger to satellites. The International Space Station was damaged in August 2018, though it isn't yet clear whether it was caused by flying debris. But despite a huge amount of junk, the total number of pieces in orbit is relatively small compared to the area of the planet, so it's exposed, that is exposed to radiation. Also, since all the bits are in orbit around the planet, less than half of them will be between the Sun and the Earth at any time. So while space junk may have an impact on the incoming solar energy, the effect is vanishing small. This is also by Les Essats de Roy, France. It has a tiny effect, although it isn't clear which direction the light is reflected. It is such a small amount to be totally negligible. One gets the impression from some articles, there's so much junk up there that it's like a swarm of gnats. But, in fact, the total mass and the total cross-section area is small. Satellites vary greatly in size, but if we assume the average one is 5 square metres, this means Earth could be packed in a field measuring 0.25 square kilometres. Or they could be all parked. So in space, they would intercept only a tiny fraction of 1% of the sunlight that is heading our planet, provided they are between the Sun and the Earth, of course. In the section of space at 2,000 kilometres above the Earth's surface, there's less than one piece of space debris larger than 1 cubic millimetre of every 10,000 cubic kilometres of space. Although this equates to a huge number of pieces of debris, that only around 34,000 exceed 10 centimetres across. The effect of space debris on solar energy reaching the planet would increase if there was a chain reaction of collisions in which one piece of debris hit a satellite, breaking it up into thousands of pieces that hit another satellite and did the same. Yet even if this happened, it wouldn't have a significant impact on the amount of sunlight reaching us. Do insects have emotions in the same way humans and mammals do? For example, would a fly feel sad if it saw its brother die? There's nothing in the behaviour of insects that suggests any kind of emotional life that resembles that of humans. Insects have very simple brains compared to mammals. I think no brains. Much of the behaviour is produced by simple reflex responses and stimuli. The second question is assuming the fly will recognise its brother, which is doubtful. There are plenty of evidence that many insects have little or no sense of family bond. A female praying mantis, for instance, famously cannibalises her male during the act of copulation. The orange trip butterfly normally lays just one egg per plant, but if she lays two by chance, then one of them resulting caterpillars will probably eat the other sibling or not. Social insects do, of course, cooperate closely with their family members and demonstrate high levels of self-sacrifice and interest of the colonies, but there's no evidence that this behaviour is regulated through emotions. Anyone who's ever disturbed a wasp or ant nest will certainly know insects feel anger, probably triggered by fear. They obviously procreate and are extremely social with their own species. I love this, though this is probably born out of more mechanical preconditioning, sexual arousal, or the need of vomiting. So while insects are evidently possessed base emotions, the question of whether they feel empathy, sympathy, love, or grief is another matter. Although humans are capable of feeling and demonstrating kindness to an insect, it remains unknown if such emotions are ever reciprocated. Oh, isn't it beautiful? Who's that person? Portsmouth. Newcastle, Portsmouth. Here's another person. This is an Indian person. Tamil Nadu, India. In his book, The Expression of Emotions of Man and Animal, Chatterjee suggests animal emotions include anger, terror, jealousy, and love. Recent research has found that insects have the cognitive physiological building blocks that might give rise to complex phenomena such as emotion. For example, bees that were given rewards when they reached a certain site became more opportunistic than other bees. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.